It's not how to guide, it's how not to guide, in fact. Coming out of the Mexico meeting, and I'm going to read the node, because it just took 5 minutes for the combined effort of me to find it. If you go to the mex.icann.org, the node for the report that you're looking at is a node /3638, and we will make sure that that's attached to the space for today's meeting. It probably should have been there as a reference anyway. What you'll find if you visit that node is a wealth of information and reporting back about an exploration across the issues of e-crime. A subset of that, which we're going to be talking about today, and I'm sacrificing much of my introduction because we're running out of time, is the abuse and the DNS. We've got some excellent panellists. We've got an exciting afternoon. I've seen some of the presentations and I know I'm looking forward to it. But the first person, the first in Australian speak, I've got to do a bit of strine, is, in fact, the first cab off the rank, is going to be Greg Rattery. Now, Greg joined ICANN in July 2008 as the Chief Internet Security Advisor, where he provides expertise on security matters, both external and internal, while managing the security group. But more importantly, Greg, you're going to tell us about the forum yesterday.
Yes, I am, sure. Do we have the slides are there? Okay. So I actually have too many slides, so I'm going to... I decided that... in order to make sure that the information was available, I'd keep the slides in, but it does mean I'll probably go through them pretty quickly. But as I did this, I wanted to make sure I placed the forum yesterday, you know, in the right context, and then report out the types of things that we heard yesterday. We have an overarching issues construct for the establishment of new GTLDs. The potential for malicious conduct is one of the four overarching issues. I think it's important because when we talk about DNS abuse or use terms like malicious conduct, they can have some pretty widely varying interpretations. So as we looked at this overarching issue, malicious conduct, we have it focused specifically on combating cyber criminal or criminal use of the DNS or the potential, in this case, for new GTLDs to contribute to increased levels of criminal activity, and how do we mitigate those activities. And we are trying to distinguish that as we carry forward the dialogue on these overarching issues from the trademark protection issues. At some level, we don't want to be too artificial. Some of the steps that might be involved in dealing with issues related to intellectual property and trademark may also relate to how we address issues related to malicious conduct. But in terms of what sorts of activities are at issue, we do see a differentiation between trademark issues, which is one of the other overarching issues, and the issues related to malicious conduct when we're talking about criminal use of new GTLDs. Also, to place it in context, we have received a wide variety of inputs to our understanding of the malicious conduct issue since the Mexico City meeting. We've had a pretty hefty set of collation of the inputs on the applicant guidebook version 2 and then analysis of those issues to include potential areas for implementation. We have an overarching issues wiki. For those of you who are interested in this issue, the public forum is effectively open in the form of the wiki, and that will be an ongoing accessible way to comment on the issues involved here with the malicious conduct. There are relevant ESSAC reports. There's probably more than the two listed there, but we do know that the ESSAC is also reporting on issues that are related to malicious conduct. And then we've had outreach to a number of groups, and you're going to hear from, we were going to hear reporting from all four of those groups here. Two of the individuals are actually on the next panel sitting to my right. And then we are conducting our consultation. We conducted our consultation here yesterday afternoon. So the panel yesterday afternoon consisted of these four individuals: Rod Rasmussen, representing the Anti-Phishing Working Group; Greg Aaron, representing the Registry Internet Safety Group; Lee Williams, who represented a consortium of banking and finance associations, as Arena Othman, who's currently in private employ, but was the person behind the stand-up of the Malaysian CERT and really representing the views of the computer emergency response community, and Bo Brendler, Consumer Reports Web Watch's founder. So we'll press right into the review of what was discussed during that panel. And what I decided to do was basically to lift slides from each of the presentations. Again, with regard to Rod and Greg, they are here to my right, so as we do discussion on this panel, we'll be able to engage them on what they said as opposed to me channeling what they said. The APWG has provided a draft input. Rod has led a working group of the APWG working through its Internet Policy Committee and has provided a draft input from the APWG on the subject of malicious conduct. This is a very important piece of work. We asked them back in the Mexico City meeting to take a focus on this. They have done that. As you'll hear, or if you look out at the wiki, it's a pretty substantial piece of work. It is draft, and Rob has described in his remarks yesterday, they plan to continue it and focus it more on issue, rather than issue identification, more on remediation measures. But one of the things that was very important that they did was try to characterize three types of issues related to malicious conduct. Basically, new issues because of the unprecedented nature of certain things related to new GTLDs, issues of scale, or the fact that the number of TLDs will be increasing, so that as the space increases, how does that impact the potential for malicious conduct? And then they did want to address longstanding concerns. There's three quick slides here. I am not going to try to identify, each of the issues under each of these categories. Oops. There we go. Rod did highlight during his presentation that registry ownership and control was the number one priority, and in their work continuing forward on this issue area, they do plan to prioritize the issues identified here and in the next couple of slides. But there's a pretty fulsome list here with regard to new issues. Again, I'm not going to read this. Scaling issues that present challenges related to malicious conduct. And again, that new GTLDs will have some of the same issues that existing TLDs have related to the challenges of abating malicious conduct. Greg Aaron, representing the Registry Internet Safety Group, structured their presentation around four questions that ICANN had asked them to comment on regarding this issue area. So you'll see in bold and italics each of the four questions that we posed to them and the responses from the RISG on those issues. And again, Greg can correct me, but I believe the RISG's basic thrust was, while it's difficult to predict future behavior, that the past can be a guide to understanding the future, and therefore, we can learn from the behavior. And in the case of this first point, it's really that we do have concrete evidence that there is a migration from TLD to TLD of malicious conduct depending on the opportunity the TLD provides and the remediation that might be present in that space. With regard to question two, we got into a little more of the technical challenges, that there are a number of things that are needed in order to deal with malicious conduct. I think Greg made the strong point that this is contextually dependent, that because TLDs are seeking to service different registrant bases and have different business models, that really the answers to these questions tend to be dependent on those factors. With regard to, does the current model work? I think Greg was fairly positive in some ways that a lot of activity has grown up around remediation approaches, that there are mechanisms for cooperation. Certainly they need to be strengthened, and information sharing mechanisms would help a lot, but this is not a green field, and that the new GTLD space should be included in the existing mechanisms that that exist. And then we did ask the more pointed question of specifically what we should we do, and the RISG really came back with two basic answers, one of which is central, you know, in terms of how do we in the applicant process identify what measures new applicants may take. You know, there's a call here for them to explicitly identify how they plan to treat abuse topics, and certainly we're taking that on board as an input in terms of process about how we make that happen. And then, you know, addressing one of the long-standing issues, to use Rod's construct, we do need to make sure that our compliance efforts continue to be robust and are enhanced, and, you know, that certainly will be taken into account. Lee Williams represented the banking and financial community. He did not provide slides, so I am channeling Lee's input. Really, you know, we appreciated Lee's input as, I think, pretty balanced. He, I think, believes that for that sector, which has real, you know, will be a target of malicious conduct because that's where financial transactions occur and the money's to be made by criminals, that there is an opportunity as well as a risk here from new GTLDs, and that if the space is properly constructed, that sector may be better off as it uses the internet than worse, but that there are risks if that does not occur, and was basically enjoining us to, we are going to engage in a dialogue with the set of financial associations and to understand those concerns and what they believe need to be done. He called out three key questions. First, should enhanced security measures affect all, you know, elements of DNS operations, and particularly do certain communities like the banking and finance community have, in the terminology of the process, community objection rights would allow them, you know, to figure out who gets to be in a dot bank or a dot finance or a dot check TLD, and that would be very useful. And Lee just walked into the room as I reprised his remarks. He also went over what the belief that there need to be, you know, hot mandates for high security risk TLDs. And then we had a good discussion about, you know, whether there needs to be a higher bar for everyone. So those were the primary areas covered by Lee. As Arena, representing the CERC community, I just captured a few of her slides. You know, basically the CERC community is part of the response when malicious conduct occurs, so they come at it from what would enable them to respond more effectively. Again, in the interest of time, I think I'm going to flip through these fairly quickly, but these were the issues identified by somebody who's a leading figure in the global incident response community. And then Bo Brendler represented the at-large constituency, and he gave a presentation which was really a demonstration of the confusing nature of some of the domain name space, you know, pointing out that from a consumer perspective, if the space is so confusing that you can't distinguish between sites that are either, you know, conducting trademark abuse or facilitating criminal activity like fraudulent sale of drugs, that the space is, you know, from a consumer perspective, a more malicious, hard-to-use space. So the way forward on this issue area, certainly as well as trademarks, I think many know there's a planned series of consultations in the cities identified here during July and early August, that we will be working with the banking and finance sector on security ideas related to security-specific TLD concerns and mitigation approaches. And at the end of the day, this good work will be rolled up into, you know, potential measures that are included in the third version of the applicant guidebook. So, Cheryl, I think that's my synopsis.
Not only a synopsis, an absolute perfect time. You've gained us back 3 minutes. Oh, I'll have to find rewards for the best speakers on these panels. Well done. Thank you. We're now going to move to the meaty part of today's event. Well, there'll be first of many meaty parts of today's event. And our next panel talks about latest developments in the fight against DNS abuse. There's a section of 10-minute sessions, and you now have all the time you need in your 10 minutes allocated. But we're going to hear firstly from Greg Aaron and Rod Rasmussen, back to Greg Rattery, and then Steve Stroud at the end. Now, having introduced Greg, I'm going to now introduce Greg. a quick shift of Greg's as we go down the table. Greg Aaron is key account manager and domain security at Afilias. I assume you're not the whole of the for security. There's more than just one. He manages registry services for the .info top-level domain and oversees Afilias' security programs designed to address domain name abuses such as phishing, spam, malware and FastFlux. Greg is the chair of ICANN's Registration Abuse Policy Working Group, and he represents Afilias on the steering committee of the Anti-Phishing Working Group, APWG. Rod is absolutely delightful because his bio says President and CTO at Internet Identity. I like that sort of bio. It's just the sort of bio I enjoy reading out. Steve Stroud, however, almost gets the Guernsey for the next shortest bio, so thank you, Steve. Steve is the director, Exercises, Projects and Review, E-Security Policy and Coordination Branch at the Attorney General's Department, the Australian Attorney General's Office. And Steve, I need to tell you, because you're here at ICANN, you must make that into a group of letters. We respond very well to large numbers of meaningless letters, so I'd like to see the letters by the end of the day. Okay, over to you, Greg and Rod.
Thank you for the kind introduction, Cheryl. We're going to talk about phishing as a way of illustrating some of the policy, legal, and operational issues that parties encounter when dealing with abuse and malicious uses of domain names. So what Rod and I do is every 6 months we publish a study through the Anti-Phishing Working Group. And our goal is to quantify what's happening out there, measure the amount of phishing that's happening in the world, understand how the phishers are accomplishing it, identify trends, and then that hopefully leads to ideas about how to fight the problem. Okay. Sorry. So we basically try to collect a record of every phishing attack that happens in the world. We collect it through a variety of means, including the Anti-Phishing Working Group's rather authoritative database, other feeds, private sources, and so forth. This is millions of URLs, but basically it boils down to a small set, manageable set of data on attacks and domain names used. In the second half of 2008, there were about 180 million domain names in existence worldwide. So we think we've caught about 99.5% of those and incorporated it into our report. So here are the overall stats, and this is a comparison also with previous periods. So when you say a phishing domain name, that means that a fish has appeared on a domain name. That does not necessarily mean on the home page, but on a domain. And you see that the number of domain names affected has gone up and down a little bit, but it's somewhat consistent over the last year and a half. Phishing can also take place on IP addresses. So if you're looking at the address bar in your browser, you would see, you know, number dot, and so forth. That actually has gone down quite a bit over the last year and a half because people are finding effective ways to dissuade that kind of activity and filter it out. So the phishers are moving away from this method. The number of TLDs that have been phished in, i.e. ones that have had at least one fish, have gone up a bit, although it's notable that a lot of these TLDs only have one or two or a handful during the period in question. Still, the number of TLDs affected has gone up. And would you like to define what an attack is?
Certainly. An attack can be, we have to define that in order to differentiate between a domain name being involved in phishing for one particular brand that's being attacked versus multiple brands. So one single domain may end up hosting several different attacks against different phishing targets.
Okay. So measuring attacks is also a different measure of activity. We started tracking that in a previous period, and the number of attacks increased between reports. However, if you look overall, if the number of domains and the number of IP addresses, the number or amount of internet resources used for phishing has actually remained fairly steady over the past year and a half. We have found that IDNs are not being used for phishing. There are certain attacks that could be facilitated by using IDNs to make people confused about what characters are being used, but so far we have not seen a manifestation of that type of attack. There are basically two kinds of domains you have to worry about. One, compromised domains. These are basically domains owned by innocent people, and the web servers get hacked into, and the phishers put up phishing pages down in subdomains or subdirectories. They do this for various reasons. One is they get free hosting. And these are also hard to take down. Basically, the problem is if you suspend that domain name's resolution, you are also bringing down the website and the email of the innocent registrant. Then we have maliciously registered domains. Phishers do go out and register domain names for their own use. They usually put them up quite quickly. That's one indication that they're using stolen credit cards in order to register the domain names. And here's an example. This is a phish that targets Lloyd's TSB Bank. And you see the URL at the top of the slide. And you also see in the address bar on the browser, you see that the phisher has put this phish down in the images directory, where most people wouldn't look to find things if they're hosting a website. And then they've put the Lloyd's name tacked on at the end, what they're trying to fool people into thinking this is the actual Lloyd's site. But what's really on this site? We see it on the homepage. This is the site of a women's organization in Portland, Oregon, USA. It's a wonderful organization. The problem is if we suspend this domain name, we're going to take this site down, and this organization would be collateral damage. So you see the real site here.
So the bottom line on the number of domains for the last half of last year were a little over 30,000. Of those, almost 80% were on compromised servers. So the amount of that were actually registered by the bad guys is about 20%. Also interesting, and this seems to be a declining trend over time, is that they are not using in the domain name itself very often variants of the brand that they're attacking. They're actually using typically fairly nonsense names and then adding the brand in either the host name or the trailing URL string. I think one of the reasons for that is that there's been a very strong emphasis on protecting brands within domain registrations, and the services that are doing that are pretty good at it. So really the conclusion out of this is that the domain itself doesn't matter. It's the resources that the criminals are going after so that they can launch their attacks. So we had to come up with a metric to compare against different TLDs. So we took the space and said per 10,000, we will give it a score. The median amongst all of the sites was 2.7 per .com, being about half is another good measure. Half of all domains registered. So somewhere in between, it'll be a pretty average type of TLD. Scores for smaller TLDs will skew higher just because of the smaller denominator. This is for the last half of last year. Problems really stick out, as you can see here. We had Venezuela go through the charts as far as where the attacks were occurring, and that was because of registry operation. It was actually Venezuela's registrar combined model, part of the government of Venezuela. And at the time of these attacks, they had just upgraded their systems to allow for easier registrations, and they were being shifted between one part of the government and the other. So there were a whole host of circumstances, a perfect storm, as you were. And it took them several weeks to get things back under control. And in the meantime, you could see up to 1,000 domains in a day being actively phishing. Thailand is an interesting one. There were no malicious registrations here at all. Those were all either on government or university servers in Thailand. So they actually seem to have a security issue there rather than a domain registration issue. On the GTLD side, you can see the numbers are fairly close throughout. What's kind of interesting, you do see that the biz and the info TLDs do have a fairly noticeable difference as far as being a lower amount of phishing being prevalent. The correlation on those two is they are actively running abuse programs and actively working with their registrars to remove domains as soon as they show up or as soon as possible. So it does seem that the inclusion of a registry abuse program has an impact on these scores. We also took a look at how long phishing sites stay up. So we monitor the phishing sites and track how long they're there. It's really an automated process, and we collect average and median. A median is a better number to use because sometimes people don't know about phishing sites, and some of them actually existed the entire 6 months of the study, for example. So phishing, we've tracked some phishing sites that have been up for years because people don't know about them. The brand holders aren't taking active measures against them. So here's the numbers for the GTLDs, and the one thing to take away from this slide is that there's a kind of a constant trend over time. If you take a look at COM and the average for registries that are doing different things, you may see a variance in time. So you see the biz and info will have some variance there. The big one up on for biz in September was those were all on compromised domains for the most part. So that really biz didn't the registry doesn't have much to do with necessarily. Being able to remove malicious domains. And for the CCTLDs, the one that sticks out here is obviously the UK. This is an example of a registrar within that system that was not doing a very good job of remediation. And so the registry operator, I know, actually worked with that registrar to help address the situation, but it can vastly impact the time difference. Just from one bad actor, or one not necessarily a bad actor, but an actor that needs help and better doing their job.
So when doing this kind of mediation work, remediation work, each of many entities has its own capabilities that it can bring to bear, and each one has a role. The targets are brand owners, the banks and so forth that get phished. They have a primary responsibility to protect themselves because the fishers are going after their money. And, of course, those banks' customers. So some of these organizations have anti-phishing resources. Some of them have teams. Some of them employ outside vendors. Some of them do a great job. Some of them not so active, in some cases even ignoring the issues. Hosting providers are really important because they and ISPs can take down individual phishing pages, so we want to contact those people. They can surgically remove the problems and leave the innocent websites up. Registrars need to be looking for malicious registrations, seeing what they can do to cull those out. And suspend domain names. Registries are in a good position to disseminate information, to contact their registrars, to push out reports, and in some cases also suspend domain names. Law enforcement involvement is somewhat diffuse. Phishing takes place across international boundaries, and in the vast majority of cases, law enforcement has no role in mitigating any specific fish. It's relatively rare. Most of the mitigation is taking place through these various private parties like the targets and the registrars and the hosting providers. However, law enforcement has a vital role to play in tracking this activity overall, and they are very interested in pursuing some of these large fishing gangs which perpetrate the majority of this kind of activity. So they're very interested in what's going on and do take vigorous action when they can. And finally, security companies and organizations like APWG are out there educating people, trading information, and trying to improve the situation overall. One of the questions that is coming up in fora here at ICANN is, what is the role of ICANN? What is its role in education? What is its role in encouraging better practices? What is its role in making policies that might affect these problems? So, our conclusions are as follows. Each of these abuse types, phishing, malware, spam, all these kinds of problems are different. They all present some unique challenges. They're approached different ways. Phishing as a problem is probably affecting about 60,000 phishing domains a year. And that's out of about 180 million worldwide. The vast majority of these domains are hacked into. The registrants don't know about it and are not responsible for the malicious activity. We see phishers moving from registrar to registrar. As soon as one registrar gets clued into what's happening, they button things down and the phisher will go elsewhere. The same thing happens with TLDs. The phishers are very rational. They're criminals. They're out to make money. They make rational decisions and search out weak links. We find that collaboration works. Working with each other is the best solution because we can bring all of our powers to bear on the problem. And unfortunately, bad guys put us all in a really bad situation. They affect all of us. They don't play by the rules that we do. And it means that oftentimes there are not any easy solutions that at a stroke would eliminate a lot of these bad activities. But we're very hopeful because there's much greater awareness of these problems, especially at ICANN over the last couple of years. And a lot more parties are coming in and making contributions to fighting these problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, a little example, I think, is coming up next. Conficker. Greg.
Thank you, Cheryl. It is certainly an example, both of the potential for computers to become outside of one's control and then thereby be misused. It's also, I think, a very good lesson in the value of collaboration, building upon the point that Greg just made. And in that vein, I do want to acknowledge a couple of people, or actually a few people. First, these slides are built by Dave Piscatello, who's over there on the far left. There's part of the ICANN team that worked on the Conficker Challenge. John Crane, John, raise your hand, please, really led the collaborative efforts with probably many in this room to undertake some sort of response to the challenges that Conficker presented and we're about to go through. And then Greg and many others in the TLD community were basically the front line of working on keeping the domain name system part of, the place where it was hard for this malicious activity to occur, and I'll describe that in a little more depth. So what is Conficker? I would like a show of hands. How many people really think they understand what a botnet is? Okay, so Conficker, this is like, I would guess that was 50, 60%, a little more than half. So I'm going to spend a moment. Conficker is a worm, which was the prelude to a botnet. It was a set of code that was able to basically increasingly distribute itself across the internet. It's probably not, the slide says there's a variety of vectors or means by which it tried to take over different computers. It goes from a worm into being a botnet when command and control channels or the people that are trying to propagate the code can actually control the hosts that the code has been inserted into. In this case, the primary place within the infected host or the place within the infected host that the code resides is in a portion of the Windows operating system. This was a Windows operating system vulnerability. And Microsoft was vigorously involved in the efforts to try to both understand and remediate collaboratively the Conficker worm. I show this slide for a couple different reasons. Certainly, this is the problem of no one geographic region in the world. The other thing is that the scale of these botnets, or at least in this case, the emplaced code base of the worm that could be turned into a botnet, is huge. Estimates vary, but anywhere from 1 million, and there's no that's the low-end estimate, to 15 million hosts are infected. The pace of infection has been steady since the mid-spring in terms of the security researchers. Tracking exact numbers is a pretty difficult proposition and part of the challenges of the collaborative response. But you do need to know that we now talk about numbers of computers that are over a million in these botnets. So part of the reason for that is illuminated on this slide. You know, if it's a vulnerability that's prevalent in a lot of, you know, a large portion of the installed base, Microsoft has processes, as do most software vendors, for trying to identify and, basically give you a patch to stop this. But, you know, the challenge is much more complex than that. A particular interesting aspect of this one and many of these Microsoft OS-based worms is the large installed base of pirated software for the Microsoft operating system, where installing a patch is not an option. So therefore, once infected, it becomes very difficult to remove the infected host. And for those who don't track this area closely, the sophistication of those who build botnets, advances by the month. They understand what is being done to stop their efforts. They quickly adapt, as we'll see here, the characteristics of the code that they're trying to emplace in order to make the defender's life more difficult. This gives a brief chronology of events, and Dave actually has a slide that goes before this, which talks about other sorts of worms in security situations. Mikolo, which was not really a worm but a bad provider. The Zerizbi bot, which gave us some experience in the types of collaborations that we would need involving the domain name system with the security community in responding. In some ways, thankfully, this bot gave us preliminary inoculations that we were able to learn from and deal more effectively as it's tried to spread more aggressively. You know, in particular, as we started to understand that Configure A affecting the generic top-level domain space started to move with Configure B into the country code domain name space, we started to understand that we needed to proactively and preemptively get out in front of the use of the domain name systems as a means for command and controlling this bot. The bot had an algorithm that basically generated domain names. That algorithm was basically hacked by the security community. It was, it was protected by encryption. It was, this is a cat and mouse game of attackers and security community. By decrypting the algorithm, they were able to proactively predict what domain names would be used, allowing, registries and registrars to go out there and take those names out of play. So for the involvement of the ICANN community in this activity, that was really where the game was played and is still being played in the different portions of the Configure, or for the different code bases in Configure that still endeavor to use the domain name system. It's interesting. If anybody does know who's responsible, there is a $250,000 reward that has been issued by Microsoft. John has thought about volunteering himself up, but, hasn't quite taken that step at this point. Again, we went through a early portion of this year and then really hit what became the widely publicized Configure CD, depending on, your labeling schema, where the worm went from operating against 10 TLDs and registering, I think, 250 names a day to going against 110 TLDs, registering 50,000 names a day, and heavily infecting or seeking to utilize the ccTLD space. So we had no game plan, as John well knows, as the guy who had to pull together one in a period of 24 to 48 hours, to really reach out to everybody and deal with a situation where 110 elements of the domain name system were potentially going to be utilized and could effectively respond to this situation. There is a configure E. It really looks like it's trying to test, you know, what works and doesn't work in the response of the security community. Importantly, configure E does not use the domain name system, and there's some thinking that we've actually done well enough in the domain name system to make the malicious code writers move on to other vectors for spreading their code. This is a map of the affected CCTLDs in the configure situation. This has been discussed in a couple forums in the CCNSO this week. We cannot figure out any rhyme or reason to actually why the code writers chose these specific CCTLDs. It may have just been they wanted us to waste time trying to figure that out, because people spent a considerable amount of time trying to figure out why different countries were or were not infected. Some positive lessons learned, and there are certainly those. While it was an ad hoc response, both the domain name community dialogued well quickly with the security community once it was understood that the domain name system would be used and that security researchers could predict where the domain name system would be used. There was a positive response by the DNS operators to actually go out there and either block or even sinkhole, you know, direct to the security researchers the traffic coming in from these infected computers, sustaining the trust that can be done in a way that doesn't give away the analysis that's being done in the security community sustaining that's an essential part of an effective response. Communication channels are essential. We played basically an enabling role in conjunction with ICANN's global partnership staff, who has regional liaisons across the globe, in getting the word out. We are not operators, so really the action took place in those TLD operations that took action on these bots. And, you know, we do need each other. We need to figure out mechanisms, and we remain engaged with the security community, the vendors, Microsoft, the security researchers, the antivirus writers like Symantec, about how we're going to collaborate going forward in the future. What we haven't solved is how to get botnet operators out of business, and I don't think that that's going to be a near-term option for us. As I've mentioned, they're agile and elusive. There's no silver bullet, as Greg mentioned, when it came to phishing in order to defeat this, and that collaboration can be complex, and we're going to have to work at and dedicate resources to be able to collaborate effectively going forward. Because Configure was the subject of a lot of discussions here at the Sydney meeting, I do think that we have learned that this is not a one-off, that whether it's Configure F or a new variant of, Worm that's infecting and infecting the internet and utilizing the domain name system, or the DNS itself comes under attack, that we must have some sort of standing collaboration mechanisms in order to address these threats. I believe Chris Despain, the CCNSO, has stood up a working group in order to talk about how that sort of collaboration can occur. Certainly we on the ICANN staff will be part of the working group and look forward to working with all in this community, the DNS community, on how to do that, as well as bridge it over to what goes on in the security community. So, Cheryl, I think that's it.
And I can rely on you to get us perilously close back to track. We're going to work more together. This is excellent. Steve Stroud is now going to discuss the Australian government's role in the establishment of a national CERT. See, when you give me letters, I'll put them out as letters. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Cheryl. I'm not going to talk about DNS per se or worms per se or phishing or anything. What I want to briefly, and I will be brief, talk about is policy levers that governments can use to assist. Now, I've got three key points that I want to make in this short time. The first is that the Australian government takes cybersecurity seriously. We call it e-security. The second point is that where we can, we try and facilitate collaboration between people who may not otherwise collaborate. And I'll come to an initiative on that in a sec. And the third point is Cheryl's point, that we're bringing together a lot of our existing response arrangements under the banner of a national cert. Now, we take cybersecurity seriously. Our Prime Minister last year outlined his view of Australia's national security, and it's broader than what you might think national security is. But in it, one of the things he said that's important to Australia's national security is e-security. It's number 9 in our top 10. For those of us in the government e-security business, that was like manna from heaven. But what we have done quite, well, relatively constantly in the Australian government is reviewed our e-security policy. We did it initially in 2001, we did it again in 2006 and discovered that things had changed dramatically. So we instituted a program of doing it every 2 years. It's a fairly hefty body of work. And we completed the last review, some of the initiatives were announced in December last year. Two things I want to touch on. One is what we're calling information exchanges. This is headed up by an organisation within our department called govcert.au. And what they are doing is facilitating information exchanges within various industry sectors. So we're getting people in a room to talk technical problems. These people are competitors, so one of the issues that we, the government, had to solve, Australia, there's fairly strict competition law, so we had to get the competition people happy with these people being competitors sitting in the room and talking about stuff. So we've got everyone to agree that security is really a non-competitive issue. And we're just kicking these off now. As I speak, there was one today. And the idea is that people bring their problems to this forum and they share and they kick around solutions. So rather than me solving my problem independently of Rod solving his problem, we get together and hopefully there's less work done and things are solved quicker. The other thing we did was announced in our last budget in May was we're bringing together all of the response arrangements in this country under the banner of a national cert. Now, we're doing this in conjunction with AusCert and the University of Queensland, and also we're bringing in all the bits of government that do this. The aim is to have essentially one place to go and also to provide the Australian people with e-security information and threat information and stuff like that. That's really all I wanted to say. Except to add that in response to Cheryl's challenge for an acronym, I would go with STVEEN, DEPRESPCBAGDA. Thanks.
I think you've actually got further brownie points because that's even longer than Bacardi, DBCDE. Congratulations, Stephen. Thanks very much for that. Well, there's something on our schedule now that means I'm hoping to see people come up to the mic. It's opportunity for question time. Come on, Philip. When you do come to the mic, just identify yourself for the scribe's sake. Thanks, Philip.
Thanks, Cheryl. Philip Argie from argistar.com, also immediate past president of the Australian Computer Society. At the Australian High Tech Crime Conference, it was on a couple of weeks ago, we had a group of people telling us that the solution to disinfecting configure-infected machines was quite well known. The policy and legislative response challenge is how to get that antidote onto those machines. And it's quite an interesting question because, of course, we have in Australia, as most civilised countries have, anti-hacking legislation makes it an offence to access somebody's computer without permission. And as Greg One mentioned at the beginning, the wormists take no notice whatsoever of that legislation and with gay abandon infect people's machines. Those with the ability to fix those machines who can also identify the machines can't insert the antidote, as it were, without breaching the law. Governments are loath to authorise that sort of conduct. What I want to raise is really contrast the way the world has dealt with swine flu. And whilst at one level it's a curious analogy, what is interesting is the way the world has coordinated its approach, the way the world has shared information in identifying symptoms, how to identify infected victims, and then most interestingly, how once those people have been identified, what's been done. And really at one level, very intrusive and some would say heavy-handed activity and sort of confining people to their homes and insisting that they take Tamiflu and matters like that. So it's kind of interesting that when the world thinks there's a serious issue, it can actually galvanise itself and find mechanisms to deal with it. How effectively is yet to be seen. But I just wonder whether there isn't a lesson there that we might be able to learn in terms of setting up structures and putting in place mechanisms that might allow identified machines to be forcibly disinfected, because in using the same analogy, cutting down the propagation is really the key to minimising and quarantining the damage. And we're really fighting with our hands tied behind our backs because we close off one of the known solutions, and that is infecting the infected machines with the antidote. We tie our hands behind our back and say we can't do that. We have to use ISPs to try to contact their customers and plead with them to do something. That's really not very effective. So I think we have to decide, if we're serious enough, actually have a legislative approach and create a mechanism for the antidote to be installed on those machines. I would suggest that the majority of owners of infected machines would in fact not have the faintest idea that you'd fix their machine. In the same way, they're totally oblivious to the fact that they've got an infected machine. So it's really a philosophical mental block that's stopping it. But considering ramifications of the problem, I really think it needs a little bit more focus at that level.
Thank you. And is there any other questions? Because wave now, otherwise I'm getting sorely tempted to take that excellent challenge and put it to this group and perhaps ask Steve for an initial response to that, and then go, boys.
My initial response would be it would be a very brave government indeed that would legislate to allow that to happen.
It's Philip, correct? You know, Philip, I think I'm very sympathetic to the notion that these particular challenges, worms, are analogous to public health sort of considerations, and that as we figure out how to do collaborative response, learning from models of Centers for Disease Control and World Health Organizations and preventive measures are something we need to consider, to include, you know, whether current legal and policy constructs are enabling or disabling of those responses. However, a little bit to Steve's point is, I do think the technology community can assert that a specific technical fix will get much farther down the road than, you know, the messy reality of code and installed computer bases. And it is a risky proposition to shove code into somebody else's computer that you don't understand its configuration and, you know, how it's operated, and therefore may break and worsen the situation. So that's why I think Steve's point that we were probably a ways from the confidence level for governments in order to enable those sorts of activities.
Dave, thank you, waving at me. Back mic.
We're dead here. Oh, that's better. This is Dave Piscatella from ICANN. One of the things that goes on in large-scale enterprise networks is something called endpoint admission control. And what it essentially is customs and immigration with immunization mechanisms for connecting to a local area network. There have been many speculations on trying to migrate that kind of technology to an internet service provider, where the service provider would essentially check to see if your machine was infected and not allow you to connect until you'd remediated the infection. The disincentive there for the ISP is quite obvious. Turning customer away, the customer will simply go to a different ISP who might not create that kind of admission control or block access to the internet. So maybe a government might not necessarily want to take the big step of saying, we're going to reach into your computer and put our own little application to control it. But it might incent internet service providers or provide some sort of funding and say, we encourage you to do this. This is the kind of prophylaxis we think is appropriate for the internet. And that might be an appropriate course for governments to take. Thank you.
Bertrand?
I'm speaking here on a personal behalf on the issue that has just been raised. Analogies carry us only so far, but they're at the same time very interesting tools to see where there are similarities and non-similarities. I think the more we speak about computer and internet security, and in particular that kind of problem like worms and epidemics, the more the difference between traditional police mechanisms and health environments appear valid, like health treatment is important. It took years to establish all the mechanisms of cooperation to prevent pandemics and so on. So I would urge as a methodological approach to avoid getting precisely the kind of discussion where a bold idea is only explored so far as to say it would take and jump to the solution too quickly. It is obvious that this is absolutely not right. It's maybe not the right approach, but it is a typical subject where we are at the core of public policy and at the core of a public policy where you not only have to understand completely the problem with the help of the different actors, and the way configure has been fought shows that governments on their own are unable to fight it without the cooperation of the other actors, but likewise, any preventive mechanism or remediation mechanism will need the cooperation of the different actors to find the technical solution, to get the legal framework to apply whatever solution there is, and the business actors who also are likely to be cooperating in this. So I just pointed this element because there are several frameworks. It's not necessarily within ICANN, but I think this session is a typical example of an awareness raising. And I think if any actor wants to try to bring together a better interaction at a very preliminary stage to say, are we completely fools to even think of what was mentioned, or isn't an analogy actually meaningful in designing public policy or thinking about it, I think it would be worth it, personally. But
any response? Rob? Greg? Steve? Everyone, go for it. First to the buzzer gets it.
I got it. I think the comments here are very good, and we do have what appears to be more of a public health issue than almost a law enforcement issue, although it's combined. There is movement within the ISP community on this issue. We are seeing the use of things like what is called a walled garden by some ISPs around the world. And that what a walled garden is basically you try and log in, and your ISP says your machine has done something, whatever that something is, and until you remediate that, we're not going to let you through to the server, through to the internet or whatever you're trying to reach. And they're wrestling with this issue of how do we do this in a competitive environment and in an area where we may take on legal risk. That's where I think, again, where we can encourage governments around the world to help service providers get past those issues so that there's a common baseline for them to work with, and then they don't have to worry about necessarily blocking somebody's access when that person is affecting lots of other people.
Steve, I'm sure you want to say something.
I want to make 2 points. One, I thoroughly agree with the use of analogies from outside computing to look at problems. We don't have our collective wisdom here looking at our own subject field. We obviously can't solve everything. Second point towards ISPs. In Australia, we have, and it came out of the review minus, e-security review minus one, is something called the Australian Internet Security Initiative. Now, I won't speak too much on it because it doesn't fall into my area of responsibility, except to say that with ISP participation, machines that are identified as infected are notified to ISPs who then work with the customer to clean them up. It's happening largely voluntary basis, I believe, but it is happening, and when it works very spectacularly well.
Go ahead.
Russ Mundy, speaking as a long-time security guy. First, I'd like to comment about the suggestion that using similar techniques to attackers use to fix infected machines is an interesting but not really a new idea at all. For folks that remember the Morris worm from the late 80s, I happened to be in the midst of trying to respond and react to that. And one of the things that many people don't remember or never knew was that in the midst of the reaction to that, which was had to be correcting code vulnerabilities that were sitting out there on machines. It was more taking advantage of code vulnerabilities rather than planting of malicious code. So similar, but not quite exactly the same. The fixes that got promulgated were not all legitimate fixes. In fact, at least one, and I think maybe two, were in fact illegitimate fixes published in a way to look to be legitimate that would have in fact infected those that were silly enough to accept those patches and put them in. And so it was an interesting and somewhat challenging realm to look at and examine that. And that's what always comes to my mind when I hear the idea of having, if you will, the good guys using similar kind of tools to what the bad guys do. I have never been comfortable with doing that for a couple of reasons. One is things that I've lived through of that nature. And because when that starts to occur, it becomes even harder to know what's the good stuff that ought to be going on to machines versus the bad stuff. And it has the very big potential of making the problem even worse than what you had to begin with. And so something that I wanted to just contribute to the discussion here. And the aspect of suggesting kinds of things that can be done to help responding to this, one of the, I'm a ESSAC member, and I'm speaking purely myself, not as an ESSAC person here, but we're currently having discussions about how to encourage and foster, especially in some of the registrar space, the higher that ways in which, from both a business and a servicing perspective, that the people that are offering this in the business realm can effectively sell it to customers, and to have some area of better security that at least over time can itself become, if you will, a positive motivation as opposed to a negative motivation. And personally, as a longtime security practitioner, I think that this is a better way to try to move forward in this kind of space, so that it is in the advantage of the ultimate end users of this stuff to actually do things that will help security, as opposed to saying, oh, well, somebody else shoves some code on machine. I don't really know what they're doing. Fine, okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, the passivity is scary. You're right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I have a question on both microphones, so if we can just hold responses perhaps till we hear these questions, please step up. And then two questions, right? Then you two in line. Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to thank these gentlemen for the hard work that they did to help stop Configure. Secondly, I'd like to ask, saw a recent presentation at NANOG that essentially said the rate of new viruses going into the wild is around 2 per second. There's indications now that there's code being generated automatically to build these botnets. And I'm just wondering anecdotally if you know how close we are to complete ICE 9, okay? And the other is if you are tracking at the anti-phishing working group anything about tiny URLs and tiny URL redirection.
Do you want to take the second one first?
you happen to hit a wheelhouse right there for me. And we didn't break it down in the slides here, but actually in our report we did mention the tiny URL is a brand. Just for those of you who aren't familiar with it, you can buy, and sometimes are free, through a service, a small domain name with a slash and then some sort of short code after it, and that URL redirects to another place. It's very popular for social networks, Twitter, things like that. The problem is the bad guys know this too, and they use that to they sign up for some of these, and then they redirect through that to their website. So you've got a legitimate domain, tinyurl, and there's several other services out there that do this, and then it redirects to those. So you don't know what it is until you get there. There are some actually browser plugins and things like this that can tell you what's actually at the other end. They were somewhat effective. But we did see a rise in this. It was a few hundred in our survey. We expect to see a lot more going forward. They're definitely on the rise.
Great. You want to? No, did you? No? Okay. Please go ahead.
So one comment on the configure situation.
The scribes would love it if you told us who you were.
My name's Andy Steingrub. One little follow-up on the configure thing and the dangers of analogies. Is that whereas in the public health scenario with something like influenza, you've got a dumb attacker, a virus. In the case of things like configure and other worms, you have a sentient attacker. And so being very public about your response mechanisms actually influences the situation, whereas that's typically not true in a public health situation, right? So be careful with drawing those analogies too broadly. And the second's a question related to the discussion we had on the APWG from Greg and Rod, and that is, if we say, the number you presented was that roughly 80% of the sites you were seeing were compromises rather than the hosted site itself being malicious. And the question is, what should the policy response to that be if somebody is hosting one of those sites, doesn't have adequate security measures, and if it's not a hosting provider that can easily take action? So we can say that it's not really their fault they got broken into, but if you look at rules about public property, for example, or even private property, there's things considered attractive nuisances, and that if, for example, you have a swimming pool and you don't have a fence around it, you're still liable if somebody falls into it and gets harmed. So the idea that people aren't responsible for that security, it wasn't really their fault, if the only effective response in some cases is a revoking of the domain, if that's the only effective response you can have to take down a malicious site, what's the appropriate response, and how does that play into some of the discussions we're having about registrar takedown?
Okay.
Great.
Thanks for the question, Andy. I can tell you about some of the experiences I've had, because I'm somebody who myself and some of my team are going out and dealing with fish every day. I do see these recidivist sites where somebody's got a site or a host, and it keeps getting broken into. That happens on occasion. But my experience is that the great majority of cases, once we tell somebody that they're vulnerable, we don't see a repeat case. So pushing information out to people in general works. They don't want it to happen again. As Steve said, I think it would be a very brave government that would require, action to be taken if someone has a vulnerable system. That's a trickier thing to deal with.
So how long until we see the malicious actors setting up seemingly legitimate websites with what appears to be a social club or something like mm-hmm. that, hosting the phishing site in a deeply nested URL as if it had been attacked? Right. I mean, so once you do that and you say that those things are off limits, you incent the, and I don't want to give, who knows who's in the audience, and I've given them an idea.
Thanks for that guideline. I said it was not to be a how-to guide.
but that's the counter to it, right?
Yeah, it's always a cat and mouse game, as you say. What we haven't seen much of that yet. Instead, what we've seen is, for instance, people trying to put up bulletproof hosting where they're bad people and they won't take down stuff. Right now what we see usually is bad guys just go out and register some domain names because that's cheapest and easiest for them to do, and that's the path of least resistance. So, yeah, certainly as you lock down one avenue of attack, they will inevitably try something else. There is vulnerable... taking action and shutting down avenues of attack is worthwhile. because the harder you make it for the criminal, the less money they're making, for example. And there is absolute value in that.
Thank you. Next.
Hi, I'm Michaela Nalan from Black Knight in Ireland. We're a hosting provider and registrar, so we see a fair amount of these problems with the phishing URLs. In most cases, as mentioned by the panel, they're sites that have been compromised. The reason I'm up here is because one of the problems we have, and it's a recurring problem, is the actual takedown notices. There doesn't seem to be a standardized format for the takedown notices. Having to read 3.5 paragraphs of techno babble before you actually get to the URL that is the source of the phishing is a waste of my staff's time. It's a waste of everybody else's time because it takes us so long to actually wade through all this junk that, you know, the site's still sitting online. And in some cases, you actually feel, well, why should I bother going to the trouble of reading this if they're not going to present it to me in a simple format? So the question I would put to you is, could you please give us some reassurances that at some point in the not-too-distant future, before I go completely grey, you will introduce within the security community some level of sane, uniform, accessible takedown format for phishing sites. We will take down sites quite happily, but for God's sake, please help us do that. Thanks.
Well, there's the challenge, gentlemen. Who's going to stand to it? God?
You first. Yeah. I'd love to have you make that same speech at the APWG. That's where most of the people who do this work are. And you can certainly tell the takedown agreements that were written by lawyers and those were written by operators. This has been an ongoing discussion within the community. And it takes feedback, though, from providers such as yourself to make changes like that. And I'll take that back to the APWG, but I'm in the space, so there's a bit of a competitive issue there. So getting providers to actually feedback to the APWG, the email was right on the site. So go ahead and get that right into the group.
Because one of the things we found as well is that in some cases it's quite hard for us to actually interact with the APWG. It's been for us as a hosting provider and registrar, we would like to be able to give you that kind of input. However, in many cases, when we look at the APWG website, for example, it's kind of like, oh, you want to join in this, you're going to have to pay thousands and thousands, which, I mean, I could be mistaken, but that's the last time when I last looked at it. There was this ridiculously high barrier to entry. And while we have things like the URISPA in Europe, and we are involved with that as well, being able to actually feedback to you guys would help us, because ultimately, we don't want those sites on our servers.
And there are other options. I'd be happy to take that offline. But you can always post things to the organization if you've got comments. So we encourage that quite a bit.
Greg?
I just think really quickly want to encourage Rod or a group like Rod's to not only have the dialogue but actually go forward to try to issue some sort of, you're not going to get one form that handles all practice. Are all situations because the need for lawyers to deal with different jurisdictional, nuances. But something out there as an industry best practice by a leading global organization would really help the situation.
Well, just following up on the legal side, I'll keep it short. If you could just give us info, then the legal rubbish afterwards would help. Thanks.
You've been at the microphone for a while. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Malcolm Hutchie speaking in an entirely personal capacity. And with reference to the old new idea, the undead idea of using worms to clean up wormholes and so forth, I hesitate to make a literary reference in such an international context, but I'm really put in mind of the ending to Animal Farm. The creatures that outside looked from pig to man and man to pig and pig to man again, but already it was impossible to say which was which. I would ask the panel for their thoughts on how, if the good guys start acting like the bad guys, we will ever know which is which.
Very nice question. Which one of... No rushing to the buzzer. Look at that. Go ahead, Greg, too.
When the fisherman goes fishing, that kind of thing. Are we better than those who we are seeking to fight? Right. You have a good point. We're people who choose to live within laws and pay attention to rules because that's the way we want to deal with each other. The question is how to create some flexibility sometimes within those rules to get good things done.
I wasn't actually just making a reference to laws because you could always change the law so as to permit it, but instead more to the norm that the law embodies.
I would just point out that I think that in the end, using the tactics of the bad guys against themselves is self-defeating, because we already talked about that a bit. You end up with the battlefield being everybody's computers, and battlefields are very ugly after you get done fighting. So I don't see the security community in general going in that direction. In fact, I'd say the ethics of the security community are very much to stay away from doing those kinds of tactics. And these issues do come up often.
So this is going to be a personal opinion, not opinion of ICANN's. But I do want to challenge the notion that computers are there to serve human ends. You know, we use viruses to fight viruses in humans. We use guns to fight people with guns. Policemen carry guns as well. I mean, this code is really not the insertion of code into a machine, to me, is not the end game of this situation. And therefore, you know, in a situation where you've got automated code generation creating botnets, we're getting a more chaotic system. And the current measures and constructs are not particularly effective. And to Bertrand's point, we may need to consider some groundbreaking sort of models. While I express my own skepticism about the utility of doing that in the current environment because of the state of technique, I'm not sure that really insertion of code is the moral issue here. So,
sir, just following up to that, do you know of any example in the world where a virus has been released into the general population so as to fight public health, as opposed to inserted into a particular patient with the consent of the patient on the treatment?
I'm sure everyone appreciates the difference, and I'm sure you can take that on notice. Please go ahead.
Hello, I'm Barry Shine. I'm president of the world. theworld.com. Generally, I just wanted to make a tangential question to what you were saying. You know, generally I consider ourselves to be living in a civilization when we can believe that our cars are locked up even though they have glass windows. We don't start putting iron bars all over them. That's sort of where we're going with all this. Now, when I think of fishing, we get a lot of fishing. We get attacked a lot. When I think of fishing, there's a purpose to fishing, right? The purpose is to get the money. The purpose is to get into your account. To get into your account, even if I get into your account with a name and a password, most of us who are honest people wouldn't be able to do the next step, even if I had your name and password, because I've got to take that money, I've got to transfer it somewhere, undetected through a series of steps, okay? So the question is, I mean, what it comes down to is a fear of being caught, a lot of this, right? So there was a tangential reference to this. Are we getting arrests? Are these people being arrested at all? I mean, even through the banking side, once they perpetrate, I realize that detecting who launched the virus and so forth, going backwards in that direction is difficult. It seems the other side of this is much more mature, right? Transferring funds to different accounts and so forth. And that somebody gets the money in their pocket, right? Somebody is walking around with that money in the end, or else they wouldn't be bothered with it. Is it just a dead end on both sides of this crime? Because, you know, unless there are arrests, you know, most people, governments work because most people voluntarily adhere to laws, even if only out of fear. Okay. Where are we?
Rod?
Yes, people are getting put into jail and put into orange jumpsuits and the like at a very much lower rate than they would for going in with a gun and robbing a bank, though, physically. That is changing. We are seeing, in some regards, law enforcement had to catch up with what was going on. We still have issues, though, because this is not a border. This is a crime that occurs across borders, and so we have a lot of issues with trying to do things with international cooperation, where we haven't seen this kind of crime easily implemented by somebody sitting in their basement able to steal $1 million out of a bank somewhere across the world. That is new. That is part of this. So the investigation techniques are the same, but they're doing it over new technology. So we're catching up. I mean, the law enforcement is catching up. But the barriers to entry are very low. The costs are very low to the criminals, and frankly, the penalties aren't all that high either for a lot of the hacking side and the theft of credentials. It's different than if you actually walked into a bank and with a gun. It's
but
a different kind of crime.
Right, and that's been going on for 100 years. I mean, people have been swindling people out of information and out of their bank accounts and so forth, you know, pigeon drops and this and that. And the other thing that's been going on, there's nothing new about that. The banks are sophisticated. Law enforcement understands this. Even the international nature of it is not new. Sometimes we get a little wrapped up in our internetness, you know.
Scale. Yeah. That's the issue.
Yeah, scale might be a problem, but still heads on a pike, you know, are often...
And the final word on this is going to go to Greg. Go ahead.
I was going to say briefly, sometimes phishing is $300 here, $1,000 there, $5,000 there. It's a diffused problem, and there are some in law enforcement who appreciate the total scale, which amounts to many millions of dollars a year. And knitting together all that activity that takes place here, there, every day into larger cases is difficult. In some cases, law enforcement is very interested in particular individuals in certain countries, and they can't get to them. And in some cases, they're not able to work with law enforcement in that country, or there's not effective action. So it's one of the unfortunate realities of geopolitics.
Well, I'd like to ask the audience to thank this, I think, brilliant, excellent, and excitingly informative panel in the normal way for what has really been very interesting to me. Thank you all, gentlemen. Now, ladies and gentlemen, while we do the cleverness of moving bodies from one side of a stage to the other, I would like to encourage you all to stand up, stretch, perhaps take a five-minute bio break, and inform you all that at 16:20, we did start more than 20 minutes late at the first session, we will be beginning our law enforcement section. Thank you all.
You can sit next to me, sir. That's good. I will go and take a comfort break before we start. And I don't have to dash out in the middle.